The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, Expanse fans, and welcome to episode 9 of The Churn, episode 10 of The Expanse, Cascade. I'm Cher Martinetti, and with me, as always,
Adam Swiderski, chicken lover.
Oh my god, the chicken.
Yeah, big theme for this week.
And as always, we're going to be joined with Ty and Daniel, who make up James S.A. Corey, the creators of The Expanse universe. And our special guest joining us this week is going to be actor Sean Doyle, who plays Aaron Wright.
Ooh, I mean, yay! No, I'm kidding.
So, as always, if you want to grab the books, if you're enjoying what you're seeing and you have not read the books yet, they're available on Orbit. You can get them on the James S.A. Corey website. Go into a local independent bookshop or purchase them online where books are sold. And if you're listening, please give us some love on iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or wherever you listen to your podcast.
But wait, we should kick things off because we recorded last week's episode the day it was announced that The Expanse has been renewed for season 3.
That's right.
So we didn't get a chance to shout it out, and now we get to celebrate. Yay!
Yay! Season 3. I'm very, very happy for them.
Yeah.
Because I hope this show gets to go all the way to the end of the books, because I want to see that happen.
Yeah.
So congratulations, guys, on that. And let's see. So this week, there wasn't as much multiple storylines again going on. We're still pretty much focused on Ganymede and on Bobby, really Bobby. So Ganymede, we have Holden and crew are trying to find Prax's daughter, and they go to a very shady, weird source named Roma,
who loves chicken.
He's like the chicken hawk from Looney Tunes, but a belter. And I know that they just wanted to laugh at that because
exactly
I heard it.
Exactly like that. Yeah,
he's the belter chicken hawk, who tries to help them track down Prax's daughter, and then Bobby basically makes a jailbreak.
Bobby goes rogue.
She goes rogue and she does the tourist thing in New York, sans the, you know, t-shirts and Statue of Liberty statues.
But we also get a very clear reveal of what exactly is going on with the Ganymede situation and that guy without a vac suit, what his deal was, his or her, I guess.
And who else to speak to this better than Sean this week, right?
That's right.
So what was your favorite part of the episode?
I think that my favorite, Amos, man, is
MVP.
MVP for me. Every time I love seeing more of his character come out and more of, you know, the way they're revealing his backstory by him, what freaks him out, as opposed to him just saying, well, this happened and this is what I lived through and blah, blah, blah. We're getting to understand him very clearly, through those moments where, you know, emotion comes out and we see Amos, and then also watching him bounce off other characters.
Yeah.
Like him and you've had him and Alex as kind of the unlikely duo, and now you've got him and Prax, who couldn't be more polar opposite characters, emotionally and mentality wise, having a little buddy moment in this episode. So that was my favorite part.
Yeah, I have to say I agree with you. Wes, like I said, has been killing it this season as Amos, and I like the reveals too, because I feel like that's more natural and organic, because that's how you would find out about people in real life. It's like something would come up, something will happen that'll make them react to it and maybe be a little bit telling about themselves and their character. So that's definitely, continues to be one of my favorite parts of the show. So I agree. And with that, let's say hi to Ty and Daniel.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey, guys.
And Sean's actually joining us from the beginning. So let's say hi to Sean. Hi, Sean.
Hey.
Welcome to the churn.
Thank
you. Hi.
Thank you for doing this with us this week. I appreciate it.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
I know we had a little technical difficulties today because Skype was down.
That's right. Technology
has failed us.
Both a cruel and wonderful mistress.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not as advanced as it is in television.
No.
That's right.
So let's talk about this episode.
Yeah, this was a big moment for Erin Wright. I was very surprised by Erin Wright's turn in this episode. I fully expected some Littlefinger level, I'm going to try to dig myself out of this whole thing with skullduggery turn. And instead, we got him basically coming clean.
Yeah, I think that he finally realized that any kind of subterfuge or under the surface moves he'd been making were not getting him any further along. And so finally, he needed to try to get an ally online, which may or may not have been a good choice.
Yeah, of the people to pick, that's a pretty prickly ally to have, Vassarala.
I can't decide if I'm more worried about his fate now or I was before this episode.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you know, from my perspective playing the character, what's been really important up till now was to make sure that he doesn't come off as some sort of mustache twirling, ulterior motive villain, and that everything he's doing is from a very almost altruistic perspective. So the fact now that he's making surprising moves, I think, has more to do with how he can continue with his intention of trying to keep Earth safe than it is about saving his own hide.
Do you feel...
How about that? How about that answer?
That was a beautiful answer.
That was
answer.
Great, man. Yeah, that was beautiful.
But do you, from your perspective, do you think that with Erin Wright right now, he's starting to feel a little bit of regret? Like maybe he was backing the wrong horse, so to speak?
Dear God, yes.
Well, you know, yeah. I don't know if it's survival.
But, well, no, I mean, and that's the thing, because is it more that Jules Pierre-Mal screwed him over and cut him off?
So it's more like he, or is he truly being like, you know, what have I done? Kind of like Magneto at the end of, you know, X-Men Last Stand. He's like, what have I done?
To be honest with you, my perspective for the entire season, second season, has been, what have I gotten involved in? Who is this man? How have I been betrayed? How am I going to rectify the situation? So absolutely. That's kind of been the kind of dominant force in his strategy is how can he manage both, he's stuck in the middle right now, and how can he manage his position with Vassarala, somehow stay connected to Jules Pierre-Mal in order for things not to go completely off the rails. But at this point in the story, they have, and he's very scared.
What do you feel like, and this might be something that even you discuss with Ty and Daniel and the show writers, and the showrunner, what do you feel like Erin Wright's motivation has been this entire time?
Truly, his motivation has been to put Earth first, to make sure that Earth is going to be dominant and safe in this ensuing kind of escalation race between Mars and Earth. I really believe that that's the case. That may or may not be true. That's not maybe how the audience will perceive it, but from my acting approach, that's had to be sort of the way forward, you know, because otherwise you're acting outside yourself. You're acting outside of me, Sean. I'm acting outside of myself and playing something that's not true and it doesn't have a sense of truth about it. So, yeah, I think he's trying to do it for all the right reasons.
I know that when we've talked to some of the other cast, they'll always say that they try to find the humanity in their character and that helps them really relate to that character and really play them. What do you feel is Erin Wright's humanity? Like, what have you found about him that you can relate to or even admire or understand?
Well, certainly that sense of being out of control, that circumstances are guiding your fate. I think we can all relate to that. And also, I think that the relationship with Vassarala is kind of central and crucial to how I've approached the character, in that she's both a mentor and a friend, and yet on some level I am to have power over her given our positions. And so the complexity of that is the thing that really has fueled the dynamic between us, and also in terms of whatever decision making he does in the show, it's all reflective of what it's going to do to that relationship, both politically and personally. You know, so that's why this was such a an anchor fulcrum episode when I actually had to come clean, because it's not just about coming clean to further his intention, but it's also about coming clean in a relationship, the way you know, as one would with any close, intimate relationship, they have to make a confession like this. There's a lot on the line, both professionally and personally. So yeah, I'd say that's really what has made Erin Wright human for me, is the relationship with her.
I was going to ask about that specifically as well, because a lot of your scenes have you paired off with Sheree, and I just wanted to talk about that dynamic and what it's like working with her and how you guys have crafted this relationship between these two characters.
Who's Sheree? I'm just kidding. Yeah, no, it's, I mean, what can I say about working with that woman? She's just incredible. She's a force of nature. She's a, you know, she's a cyclone that comes in the room and you just try to keep up. Yeah, it's been wonderful. It's interesting working with her because we have some in-depth dialogue about the scenes, you know, what's happening in the scenes. The writing in the show, as you well know, is really dense. There's a lot going on a story level as well as a relationship level. And so sometimes making sure that you're really crystal clear on how all that stuff is evolving is really, really important. So, yeah, we have a great time together. We're free to talk about anything we need to talk about with the scenes. And, of course, she's got a crazy sense of humor. So we're always teasing each other. And, yeah, it's a great time. Wonderful.
Are you jealous that she gets all the swear words?
Well, of course.
And the better wardrobe?
And the better well, that's subjective, isn't it? Come on now. Yeah, well, I swear enough in real life, so that's fine. I don't have to worry about that.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's like heavy lifting going on with that wardrobe with that woman. I mean, it was easier in second season, but just the mechanics of getting all that together, getting her ready for the scenes. It's so intricate, those costumes.
Yeah.
They're stunning. You know, they're stunning in real life and they're stunning on the show. It's certainly worth it.
Yeah, a lot of people actually ask about her outfits on the show.
Oh, really?
And then somebody actually asked if the jewelry was real. I was like, come on. That one necklace, that one, like, I think it was a couple weeks ago. I'm like, that necklace alone would have been like a few million dollars. Like,
no, it's totally, totally real. And I'll tell you, it's really, really distracting when you've got like 7 security guards on set with us.
Right.
Guarding all the jewelry. It's really, it's not a good idea. Next season, they're going to go with seashells, I think.
So prior to, you know, being on The Expanse, were you a big sci-fi fan?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I have not been a big sci-fi fan, with the exception of Battlestar Galactica. I was doing a show called Big Love for HBO a bunch of years ago, and one of my castmates on that show, Matt Ross, wonderful guy, now a really successful director, kept saying, you got to watch that show, man. You got to watch it. And I kept saying, well, Battlestar Galactica, I remember it as a kid. And I finally watched it and, of course, became a junkie and have watched the whole thing twice. And was really excited when I heard that there was another show coming along that had the intention in terms of it being such an epic space opera as that. So, yeah, I would say that is my key into sci-fi. Battlestar Galactica.
So far, Sean just became my most favorite cast member, because every time we've asked that question, people are like, oh, Star Trek or Dune or did that. He's the only person. Yeah, you're the only person that said Battlestar Galactica, and that's my favorite.
Oh, my God. How could that not be everyone's favorite in the entire world, with the exception of The Expanse?
Right. I concur. Right, of course, yeah. I agree wholeheartedly. So you just became my most favorite person in the cast so far.
So you as well.
So is that when this project comes on your table, you know, and you're, oh, it's a sci-fi show called The Expanse. How much did you look into the books and what was out there about it already before you dove into creating Erin Wright on screen?
Well, you know, it came to me in an odd way. I was asked to be a recurring character, and I suppose this might be a little out of school, but what the hell, it's 3 years ago now. They asked me to play this recurring character, and at the time, I couldn't commit that because I needed to get a series. I was just finished my own series and I needed to kind of, you know, secure my work for the future. And when you, and often when you sign up for a recurring character in a show, that means that you're going to compromise other opportunities that come along, right? Like other regular characters on shows or what have you. So when we first talked, I talked to them and then they came back and made it a regular character, like an option character. And so I read, I think, 3 episodes at the time, and the writing was just, it was just a page turner. So not only was I very grateful to be offered a job with an income that I needed at the time and a character that would potentially be very interesting, it was also really fun to read. And the character, of course, it was explained to me up front that it was important that he would be in the background for the majority of the first season, because that's just the machinations of how that storyline would develop. And so that was kind of interesting too, from an acting point of view, how you can kind of stay alive and keep whatever, you know, the reality of what's happening to that character alive, even though you don't often get a chance to show that. So that was kind of intriguing to me. And then I read the first book and it's great. Love the book. But as it's not written from the perspective of my character, it wasn't helpful for the acting of the role. So, so thanks a lot, guys, for that.
I'm sure there's an Aaron Wright novella coming up.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I have to say that.
Or a tome, Aaron Wright tome.
Right, perhaps. Exactly. A whole spinoff series.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, the fact that like he was so in the background, it's made him more of like a scary unknown entity, so to speak. Like, because you knew he had something up his sleeve.
Yeah.
Or going on behind the scenes, and it's actually made him a little bit more threatening because of that.
Yeah, it's more sophisticated, right? It's you're exactly right. It's like any of these power behind the kings, the thrones that we've seen in literature, or actually we see in politics right now, even. And that's you don't understand what their motives are. You get a sense that something's going on, but you don't have any kind of clear idea what that is. And yeah, you're right. That's dramatically, it's way more effective.
Aaron Wright is like the Steve Bannon of the Expanse.
Oh, God.
I wasn't going to say it, but it's your part.
I said it. I know you didn't really get to do a lot of scenes with Thomas Jane, but how do you feel that the vibe of the show changed once his character, you know, became one with Venus and the proto molecule?
Well, this is going to be, this is not going to be a satisfying answer for you guys, but we shot, it's a huge show. Mm-hmm. Right? It takes place in different worlds and therefore it takes place on different sets and different times. And so I was never around for those storylines. I would come in on the days that we shot our stuff on Earth in the studios. So in fact, it was an odd situation. It was very much in isolation how this show is shot. So I have a very clear idea of what the energy is and the mood was when we shot all our stuff on Earth and how that was tied in with the rest of the story. But in terms of everything else that went on, those were almost like other films.
Are you sad that you don't get to shoot in space?
Of course.
Yeah. Or get like a zero G scene or something like that?
Yeah. Doesn't have to be a sex scene though. Just flying around would be fine. I walked through the set, the other sets. The studios here are fantastic. We're at Pinewood here in Toronto, which was created by the Ridley brothers originally, and the sets for this show, and I'm sure you guys have talked about it ad nauseum, but I mean, to see them in real life is just staggering. 2-3 story high sets for these spaceships and whatnot. It's just beautiful, beautiful work.
Yeah,
it's like being a boy, you know. It's like being pretend.
I got to come do a set visit during the first season, and they had us like climb in like up to the next level. I think it was in the Rocinante. That you actually, yep. Yeah. And it's just crazy. I actually got scared because I'm not great with heights. Yeah. And we had to get like up on top of like the whole thing to look down into where, I'm just like starting to get a little lightheaded thinking about it actually, but it's intense.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. They're amazing, amazing sets. Beautiful.
Can you, you had mentioned that it was important to you from the start, for Aaron Wright not to be a mustache twirling villain, but you certainly were in something of an adversarial, shady goings on behind the scenes role. Can you talk a bit about how you find that balance between, you know, being able to be ostensibly villainous without turning into a villain?
Well, I would say this. For me, as I'm doing a play right now, actually, in Toronto, which I haven't done in 10 years, and it's really exciting, and it really kind of points out the difference between acting on stage and film. When you're acting in front of a camera and in a TV or in a television show or film, the character is determined by so many different things. It's not determined just by your work. It's determined by the editing. It's determined by the writing. It's determined by what coverage is used for you, you know, so many things. So it's not important for me to determine whether my character is a villain or not, or if he's bad or good or not. All I can really do is try to be present in those moments, try to understand what the hell I'm talking about, try to get what I need out of another character in a scene. And I think for me, all of that, the way I approach that with this guy is his vulnerabilities, his fears about being in over his head, being in relation to people who had more power in the situation than he did. And so I guess the simple answer to what you're saying is try to be vulnerable with everybody and then trust that, you know, the character will be represented properly in the final cut and in the final presentation of the show. Does that make any sense at all?
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I guess as a follow-up question for Ty and Daniel, because we've talked a bit about how certain actors and characters bring things to the role that has changed the way they've been written or been portrayed on screen. Is there anything, or can you speak to Sean's performance and kind of how or if that shaped the way Aaron Wright developed over the course of the past couple seasons or season and a half?
This is Ty here. I don't think it's any secret that after the first season, the Aaron Wright role expanded because everybody was so in love with what Sean does, even with the smallest scene, that we were looking for excuses to put more Aaron Wright stuff in the second season. And honestly, I think his story has the most interesting arc in the set. I mean, it's not the one with the explosions and all that stuff, but if when you've watched the 13th episode in a couple of weeks of this season and look back at Aaron Wright's arc over this season, it's actually astonishing work that he's done. And it, for me, one of the most exciting things about getting the third season is that we get to see the rest of his story now, because, you know, a big part of the sort of the climax of his story happens in the third season. So now we get to do that. And I'm really excited.
I would like to say, first of all, I really appreciate those words. And secondly, what he's really talking about is that next year I get to wear Abbas Rala's wardrobe.
Yes.
Well, spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
That would be the perfect culmination for his character arc.
But are you going to spend as many hours in hair?
Daniel was pointing this out when we were watching an episode a little while ago. There's this amazing moment where it's where the Martians and UN officials have sat down together, and it's where Abbas Rala is talking to Bobby about her friend who wanted to move to Mars and died, and the camera just sort of looks over at Sean, and all he does is sort of look down at his lap. And you absolutely know he's thinking about the fact that he was involved in having that guy killed. And it's just a beautiful, subtle, tiny little moment. But, you know, you point the camera at Sean for 2 seconds, he's going to give you something awesome.
Just to give the love back there. Hey, Ty, how are you doing, buddy?
Yeah, good.
Nice to hear your voice. it's just occurring to me now when you're asking questions about you know, approach to character and everything that we just talked about. When we first sat down for season two, we did a few days of rehearsal, which was basically just trying to get us up to speed with what was happening and what these scenes were about in the first couple episodes and whatnot. And Ty was there. And the amount of love and care and also eloquence that he had about everything that was going on in those episodes. Because I would just say, I'm stupid, man. I don't understand what this is. What is this referring to? You know, what am I supposed to be doing here? And just the amount of attention that these guys had given to all of this and how absolutely specific it all was. It was both a refreshing and also really impressive and kind of exciting. Because then you go, okay, it's pull up your socks time. It's like put on the big boy pants because you're working with people who have a very high bar set right now. So you really got to go in and, you know, commit 100%.
This has nothing to do with anything we're talking about, but I have to ask this question.
Oh, God. I know what the question is. Go.
Sean, how often do people tell you you look like Mike Rinder from Leah Remini's Scientology show?
That is zero times.
See?
Dude, he does.
I don't even know who you're talking about.
Oh, my. You got to Google him because you'd be like, okay, he looks
but
like.
But do I really have to Google him? Is that a good move for me?
I will say that I did see a picture or two where there was a resemblance.
But now whenever I see Aaron Wright, there's like these moments where it's like he has this look on his face where it's like he knows he's doing this evil thing, this bad thing or ruining people's lives. But then it's also sometimes you feel like there's a little pang of guilt.
Oh, well, again, it's like I don't think he ever thinks he's doing something evil. I think he's trying to do whatever he can to sustain Earth's preeminence and superiority and power and safe well-being. I think that's what he's trying to do. And the voices that he feels are the ones going, oh, my God, what have I got us all into? Mm-hmm. How have I compromised myself? Where's my integrity? How am I going to rein in this crazy billionaire guy that I've gotten in bed with? How am I going to rein in Satan, basically? How am I going to manage this deal with the devil that I've made? So, yeah, I don't think I ever approach it from a place of I'm doing something really bad. I think I'm trying to do something really good.
Sean, there's been
clearly I'm really loving to talk about all this.
Yeah, I know.
No one's asked me before. Now it's all coming out. the idea that from this moment on, you know, further to what Ty was just saying, something now happens personally between Avasarala and I, and the story becomes much more personal in how all this evolves. And it's taken out of the realm of, you know, what's happening with the well-being of Earth and the politics in the system and whatnot, and it becomes hyper-personal.
And she's got your whole fate in her hands right now, man.
And my future wardrobe.
Yeah, yes. And your future. That's exactly it. That's why you start dressing that way, because you have to make sure that she knows you're on board.
I
figured it all out. Yeah, sure.
Man, you're good.
I know. But so there's been a certain fandom that's sprung up around the show. Have you had any interactions online or anything like that with Expanse fans? And can you speak to what that's been like at all?
I've kind of been removed from most of that. And I would imagine that that's a function of being the quote unquote bad guy in the show, right? It's about, I would imagine, retaining some of the questions and mystery around him. I've been into the last few tweet fests, and that's interesting. People are starting to appreciate what he's about or what he's conniving with. But no, my access to that kind of, or not access, but my contact with that has been pretty limited so far.
So you haven't had anyone sending you hate mail or anything like that, telling you how evil you are?
Not for this show.
Not for this show.
I always think of Jack Gleeson from Game of Thrones, who played Joffrey, and how every interview that I ever saw with another member of the cast, the first thing they said was, Jack Gleeson is the nicest guy, because everybody hated him so much. So you just haven't engendered that full-on white-hot hate.
I mean, I think it's safe to say, and I've never been like the biggest Game of Thrones person, but I think it's safe to say that everyone knows Joffrey is one of the worst villains.
Sure. Aaron Wright is not on that.
Ever.
Yeah. I mean, that character was, the level of narcissism and evil that character exudes was unbelievable. And that actor was amazing.
Yeah.
You hated him so much.
Which is really kudos to him as an actor.
Sure.
You know?
That's what I loved about this scene with Aaron Wright in this episode, because I was ready to hate him. I was ready for more like him covering his ass, and instead he just came out, like you said, in that vulnerable place.
Yeah.
Or from that vulnerable place, and it made it so it like deflated my hatred for him almost instantly.
Yeah, because he's a human being again, right? It's interesting, you know, I've been lucky enough to play such a varied spectrum of characters, and whenever I'm playing the good guys, I'm always hoping that I can play a villain, or wishing I was playing a villain. Whenever I'm playing villains, I want to be the good guy. It's you know, you're just never content, because I guess you know, as human beings, we always want to express all we are, as opposed to just one color. And that's why I think it's interesting that that happened in that scene.
What, I mean, I just have one more question for you and then we'll let you hop off. But of all the roles, not Aaron Wright, not included, what's been your favorite role that you've played so far?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's a really challenging question. Well, you know, like there's three that come to mind, and again, in no order, and it's probably not my favorites. They're just the ones that I'm thinking of at the moment. I played this character in Big Love called Joey, and he was somewhat of an emasculated man child. And that was an interesting experience because it was about kind of sublimating any adult male impulses I had to play this guy who was always sort of slightly behind the eight ball and behind everybody else. So that was interesting. And then after that, I left to do a Canadian show called Endgame, where I played a Russian chess master stuck in a hotel solving crimes, of all things. And it was a really over-the-top, crazy character. And so that was just fun because he messed with people all the time. And in fact, right now, there's a show that Anna Paquin and I have done that's airing here in Canada and will likely be in the States at some point soon. It's called Bellevue, and it's a murder mystery in a small town. And you haven't seen it, so no one's going to know what I'm talking about, but it's a character that has very kind of, what's the word, indirect moral journey. How about that? It's like a gray character, you know, it's not black and white. You just don't know what side of the fence he sits on. And those are the most interesting characters to play, I think. The ones that are just like human beings. We have light and darkness. And
I was going to say, with that and Aaron Wright, that's becoming your specialty now.
Yeah.
Dear God, maybe it is.
I got to say something that won't make much sense to you, Sean. But Adam, you should know that in the last episode of this season, you will get an Aaron Wright shirt off scene, so you will be able to judge his abs.
All right. Well,
because Adam spends all of his time judging everybody's abs.
It's true. On that note,
and there's, you know, the reigning champion.
Oh, hang
Stephen
on. What was my rating though? What was my rating? I'm sorry, I missed that part.
Oh, we haven't gotten to it. I haven't seen it yet.
He hasn't rated you yet, but he did say that he's making the ideal man, and you have now been added to, there's a part of you that he's
right.
going to add
so
to that.
So I am a great admirer of Stephen Strait's abs, and I've said that from the beginning. And then, so we had Terry Chen looking very soulful into the camera last week, so his eyes are now there. And Aaron Wright's hair, I think Aaron Wright's hair is impressive.
Yeah.
And on yes. that note, so
it just got weird.
Yeah,
and,
it just got really weird. So on
it's
that.
So,
So Sean, thank you for taking time out to do this with us today. I really appreciate it, especially since we had a little issue getting you first, but thank you for making the time to talk to us, and I'm looking forward to see where Aaron Wright's arc goes.
Definitely.
Yes, thank you. A real pleasure, guys. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Sean.
Take it easy.
Bye. So let's talk about the episode.
Yeah.
Do you want me to start or do you want to start?
Go ahead. After you.
Oh, okay. What's with the chicken? what's with the chicken in the can, guys? I need to know what's with the chicken.
Sometimes a guy likes chicken. Everybody has their little fetishes. This guy's into canned chicken.
Now, this isn't actual chicken, right? This is space chicken.
Well, this is probably grown in a vat. Some right. places. This is some chicken stem cell that was expanded out to fit into a can. With a little bit of juice.
So is it like the chicken? It's not like the chicken in the can where, like, you know, they actually have a chicken in the can.
Yes.
I did not know that.
It's a whole chicken in a can.
That's a big can.
Like, I'm not kidding. They have a whole chicken in a can.
It might be like that. They just didn't ever grow the head.
Right.
But this one, though, but if they're eating it with like a fork.
These are the important questions. We want to know the science behind the chicken on Ganymede.
I had so many questions because.
This is more like chicken spam, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
Chicken product.
There we go.
Yeah, chicken product.
Chicken product.
Extruded chicken product.
But what made you decide that this was like his thing? Like, where'd you come up with that?
That's actually from the second book.
Yeah.
When they go to the guy, and it's not that the guy is obsessed with chicken so much. It's just that, you know, it's tough to get protein on this, on Ganymede right now. And this canned chicken is the most ubiquitous form of portable protein. So, you know, that's, he's trying to collect as much as he can so he doesn't starve to death when everybody else does.
Okay. I also noticed he had pasta too. He had a storage of dry pasta. He did. He had canned
chicken.
These
are the important details you hear about only on the churn.
Yeah. I happened to notice that. And I was like,
chicken and pasta.
Chicken and pasta.
And there you have the roots of contemporary science fiction.
There you go.
Chicken and pasta.
So another thing that, another moment that really stuck out to me in this episode is when we see the guy eating the leaves. And it stuck out to me because remember how last week I told you guys about that documentary I watched, Cries from Syria?
In Syria. Yeah.
There's a moment in that documentary where the kids are eating leaves because there's no food. Like, their town is closed off, so they don't have any food.
Yeah.
And the people that are left in the town are eating leaves. So it just was jarring for a moment.
There were things from this episode that really jumped out. I mean, the statement that, and I can't ever remember this character's name, but he was originally the chaplain, the Martian chaplain, who is now like basically Bobby's chaperone, who said truth and fact are not the same thing. That was a line. I was like, wow, that is certainly very topical at the moment.
And we totally wrote that years ago before any of this was topical.
Yeah.
That's just crazy.
It just worked out that way.
So I want to talk a bit about Bobby. So she's what's going on with her? Because I've watched the episode again a couple times, because I usually do, and I can't get a read on where she is. Like, if she's, you know, her longing to see the ocean and all this other stuff, if it's really just because, like, she feels that Earthers take advantage and they have all this beautiful stuff, or is she starting to feel like, I don't want to say regret, but she's starting to feel a bit like she's been lied to and she wants to kind of like experience these truths herself, because she hasn't.
I think the word that I'd use for her in it, and where she's getting to in this, is unmoored. She had an identity. She had a role, and that's gone now. I mean, it died on Ganymede. And who she is now is up for grabs. And that's something that you see anytime somebody goes through a serious change in their lives, a serious change in the narratives of their lives. It doesn't even have to be as traumatic as the one that she's facing. There's that sense of not knowing how you fit into things, and of needing to figure out what the rules are for you now. I mean, that's how she reads to me.
Yeah, I mean,
I was going to say, I mean, my answer to that would be, even if you asked Bobby herself that question, I don't think she would know what the answer is. I'm absolutely agreeing with Daniel. She doesn't know where she fits in anymore, and she's processing PTSD from this horrific incident. She's trying to process that while all the people around her who should be helping her are instead manipulating her and gaslighting her and trying to get her to do things she knows aren't right. That's a tough situation to get your head around.
And I think even like her walk through the shanty town was such a, it even contributes to that, because she said earlier, Earthers are all fat, living off the take, you know, they don't have it hard like us Martians. And she's seeing these Earth people who are destitute and starving, and that even that like conflicts with her entire worldview.
And who don't have access to healthcare.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Good thing that's only science fiction.
Right. Yeah. We would never put mentally ill people out on the street.
No, never.
Yeah.
If you listen closely in that scene, there's actually a little drone flying overhead reading off an ad for getting people onto basic, like, because the idea is those people who are living down there are unregistered. They're unregistered births, so the government doesn't know those people exist, and so they don't get the basic assistance that everybody does. And so there's this little drone flying overhead going, it's so easy to register and get on basic assistance. And the thing I love about that is there has to be some reason why those people would rather live the way they do than register with the government to get on basic assistance. And just what that says about registering with the government is just an interesting sort of background world building grace note.
So let's talk a little bit about basic. Like, what exactly is it, or what did you guys envision it as, and why are these people not registered?
Well, so in the universe of The Expanse, everybody who is born legally is automatically registered as a citizen of Earth. And by born legally, I mean you have a procreation license, because on Earth you have to get a license to have babies. And you're, you know, born in a hospital, whatever. So all those people are automatically registered. So if you have a kid sort of off the grid, you know, you don't get a license, or you're not a registered person yourself, those kids are unregistered births. So they don't get any of the government assistance. They don't get the healthcare. They don't get the food and the housing and all that stuff. And what you're seeing there is you're seeing how Amos grew up, because Amos was one of those unregistered births. So you're sort of seeing the world he came out of. And some people will choose never to be registered because, for whatever reason, the life they want to live doesn't fit with what the government program for its citizens is. And so they'll just stay off the grid.
And basic, I mean, one of the things that people make a kind of conflate is basic in The Expanse and basic income, which is something people have been talking about recently, where everybody who's in a country just gets a stipend to live on. Mm. Basic in The Expanse is not money. It is very specifically not money. It is just services. So it's not a pleasant way to live. I mean, it's the one where you can say, oh, yes, you will always have shelter. Your shelter is going to be in a suburb outside of Detroit. You'll need to be there in 2 weeks. Here are your four roommates. Congratulations. We got you covered now. So nobody has to be homeless, but nobody who's doing that is getting the autonomy to make their own decisions about where they live and what they do.
So it's interesting that, you know, for the Martians, that image suddenly becomes living fat off the government, you know, like it's they don't see it that way. They see it as people not having to work.
Yep.
It's interesting.
But what?
Well, I mean, look even in our country about the narrative that certain political groups spin about welfare, mm-hmm. that welfare is it's what lazy people do, and you live high on the hog on government expense. I grew up in a very poor neighborhood. I knew a lot of people who were living on welfare. Nobody was living high on the hog. Nobody was spending all their welfare money on heroin and cigarettes. But that is the narrative that a certain group will spin about those people to sort of denigrate these people who don't have any choice. And you could totally see how Mars would spin that narrative. Like, look, they get free housing and free food and free entertainment. They're living high on the hog. But when you actually look at the life that they live, it's not at all that. It's just a story we're telling about them.
Which actually fits in with how Bobby is coming unmoored.
Right.
With how Bobby's narratives about who she is and what her place in the world is and who she has been championing is all getting a little rickety under her.
But I love...
And part of that is getting to be on Earth and see, oh, this isn't what I thought it was.
But I love, my favorite part also was that when Avasarala came to her, she wasn't just suddenly like, okay, I'm on your side now. Like, she's still very much at sea, so to speak, because she's by the ocean. But no, but just doesn't immediately jump into bed with someone who she's been taught for decades to think of as the enemy.
Right, but like, think about that. Like, she's a, you know, like Avasarala says earlier in the episode, she's an exemplary soldier.
Yeah.
She's always done what she's been told to do. And now, if you go through so much of your life, especially your adult life and your career years, even though she's still rather, you know, youngish, but to be considered an exemplary soldier and always doing what you're told, and now it's like, no one's giving her orders.
Who's going to tell her what to do?
So when you're a soldier without orders, you do feel out of place in the world. But then at the same time, it's like you're being told now that like you were, despite being a great soldier and being a gunnery sergeant, you were basically bait to test out this thing.
Yeah.
And that you're expected to die. You were not supposed to live to tell the story that you're telling, which is probably now in her mind, like, oh, this is why they keep telling me not to talk about that figure. You know, so that's like a lot to process. I don't think that anyone would be like, oh, at the drop of a dime, like, oh, screw this person, you know?
And it was really interesting, even just Frankie's performance. Mm-hmm. We keep doing this. As she was walking around, you know, I was like, man, she's walking weird. I don't know what's going on. And then it took me a second for it to occur to me that it was because of the agoraphobia and because of the gravity and everything. And she was bringing that physicality in very much, and really jumped out once I recognized it.
Yeah.
That she was doing that.
I just wanted to kind of note in passing here that the idea of a government sacrificing its soldiers, of experimenting on people who it is expected to represent and care for, has a lot. That's another thing that we're pulling from history that has a lot of precedent that we don't like to think about. So Bobby's facing a situation that a lot of people have faced before, and a lot of soldiers have faced before, in coming to understand that the people to whom they are loyal aren't necessarily who they thought they were. This wasn't a relationship they thought they were in.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. So speaking of Bobby walking around, what was the deal with the gentleman that taught her how to walk and then he poof disappeared?
He wasn't really there. He was in her head the
whole
time.
Well, was he? Was she hallucinating or like
No, he's a real guy. he showed her how to do it and then he left. You know, I mean, he had shit he needed to do.
So he pulled a Batman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm gonna remember that trick for the future. It's like, look over there at that thing and then
he just
run
ghosted
away.
Her. Yeah. It's
awesome. Right.
But in person, that's impressive.
Yeah.
All right. So then then everything that's going on in Ganymede. So we learn a little bit now. I know I'm jumping all over the episode, but it's okay. So we learned a telling piece of Amos's past, which is obviously that his birth mother was.
We should preface this, by the way, that we are speculating.
I'm speculating this.
Right.
All
based
day.
On only what we've Listen. Seen in this episode, because we've had some people online worried about spoilers. No, I just want to say.
No, I know. Every time I say something, I'm speculating.
Right.
I've not read past the first book. I have no idea that anything. This is just me making the assumptions based on what I've seen and up to this point on TV and the previous season.
Which is fine. That's
okay.
Yeah.
So that being said.
We don't know either.
Yeah.
So that being said, if I'm saying it, it's 9 times out of 10 I'm pulling something out of my ass. But in this case, I'm assuming, based on the conversation that he had with Prax, where he was talking about why he had the reaction he'd had to Roma and how he's a bully and that guys like him will take young girls and basically pimp them out. And then once they even get pregnant, we'll pimp them out again. And then once they have the baby, pimp them out some more. And then eventually pimp out the babies, the kids. So I'm going to assume that Amos is speaking from experience here. Are we seeing like a tinge of like behind the curtain? What's going on?
It's not like we've been subtle on that.
Well, I mean,
when in the first season, when Amos is on Tycho and they're in the club that has some prostitutes working in there, you know, he pulls over one of the male prostitutes and warns him about one of the potential Johns. And, you know, Alex makes fun of him like, well, you know, what are you, their union rep? And then he says, this is honest work. It's more honest than most. I mean, he's speaking like somebody who has done that job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when he's talking about what happens, and he's talking about what happens to these unregistered people, you know, these people that have fallen through the government cracks and are not being taken care of and are not being monitored. you know, how do they make money? How do they survive? And this is one of the ways that they do that. And he's talking, I mean, it's very clear he's talking from experience there. I mean, there's a reason why his childhood was so horrible that he became Amos.
Yeah. And it's really interesting seeing the difference in, I'm a big fan of like physicality and acting, and it's very interesting seeing the difference between Amos reacting emotionally and Amos being violent in a utilitarian sense.
Yeah.
You know, because there's definitely a stark contrast between when he's, you know, he's just got a job and he's going to beat this guy up for that reason, or when he's really kind of letting his control slip a little bit.
And speaking of letting, you know, beating people up and letting control slip, we also noticed that Holden was not really adverse to,
yeah, man,
to Amos beating in Roma's head. And Naomi was not at all okay with this.
Right.
Yeah. Naomi's line about how every shitty thing you do makes the next shitty thing easier.
Right.
That's like, for me, that's the most important line of the hour. That's the, you know, okay, we're the good guy. How long are we the good guys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it kind of informs every, you know, everything Mars is doing with, you know, sure, they may have had a good reason to start getting in bed with Jules Pierre-Mau or whatever, but now it's leading to them having to kill their own soldiers and all this different stuff. So yeah, it definitely is a central theme.
But then, right.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the two fights, you look at the fight where Amos beats up the guy who's attacking Alex in the bar. And then when he's hitting the guy with the chicken, you know, when he takes out that guy in the bar, he's not even breathing hard.
Yeah.
He's just like, you know, he's just like, hey, everybody okay? It, like, it's exactly what you're talking about, Adam. It's totally utilitarian. It's like, that guy needed to go down. He's down now. I'm done. Everybody move on. Whereas the guy with the chicken, who's, you know, basically holding a little girl's life hostage to get more chicken, Amos clearly reacts to that very differently because he is breathing hard and he's got the crazy eyes.
Oh, and that moment when he puts the gun to his face and it just very quietly says, you're going to help us. I was like, ooh, that was creepy.
Do you know what? So I love that online during the live tweets, almost every week there's been the like mashup to like a random pop culture thing with The Expanse. And like, I think one week they did like Love Actually, but it was like Love Expanse. It's just like, it's just very funny. So they'd be like memes out of it. But they also come up with nicknames, and Amos's nickname on Twitter is Murder Snuggles.
Yes.
Which is.
Is Wes aware of that? Did he see
Yeah, he's
tweets?
Totally aware of it. Yeah. He's like retweeted it.
Yeah. Wes knows.
Yeah. How amazing is that?
That's perfect.
It is perfect. Yeah. He's Murder Snuggles. But yeah, so Holden telling Naomi, like, I would have stopped it in time. Would he have, though?
I don't know. I mean, and this carries off of last week, but we saw how little he reacted to the freighter captain being murdered. Yeah, things are, and I just, this is one of the things I really like about this show, and it's the same thing with Amos's character development here. I mean, we're seeing this happen with Holden without shining a spotlight on it and flashing lights that are saying, look at what's happening to Holden. Yeah. It's just kind of there and feels very organic.
But it's kind of been like that with everybody in the show, because like we were just talking about with Sean, you know, and Aaron Wright having that moment last episode where, you know, Avasarala mentions her friend that died on Mars, and then Aaron Wright just kind of looking down. So it's like there's so many of these subtleties happening really with everybody on the show.
With Holden especially, and you know, Daniel's pointed this out before, he has the most thankless job because he has the longest story arc, so his changes are always very subtle. But I mean, the going into season two, the mandate for him always was that Eros has broken Holden. You know, he's playing like he's okay, he's playing like everything's fine, but clearly that experience broke him, and he's dealing with the PTSD from that. And his way of dealing with that is the protomolecule has become his white whale. You know, he's Ahab. He's going to chase the protomolecule across the solar system and destroy all of it so that can never happen again. And he's slowly slipping into that place where anything he does to accomplish that goal is justified.
Which is kind of the opposite.
And Naomi's there to point out. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say that's, I mean, he was very much against that mindset in the beginning of the show, you know, season one.
Yeah. No, yeah. And Naomi's the one who's pointing that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And and now he's turning into he's drifting over into the territory that Miller left behind, kind of gifted him when he left. The one where it's like, oh no, this is someone who needs to be shot in the head. I guess I'm going to kill him. And we've seen Holden. We saw Holden murder a bunch of kind of Doctors Without Borders analogs because it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, that left a mark. This is the guy who at the beginning of this series didn't want to have any authority over anything, didn't want the burden, and now it's him doing the stuff he thinks he has to do because he has the burden, and it's terrible.
And think about that. I mean, the thing that justified destroying that Doctors Without Borders ship was that if they got away, if they transmitted, people would come and they would get samples of the protomolecule, and it wouldn't end with Eros. If there's protomolecule everywhere, if it's not all destroyed, then that was just murder. I mean, in Holden's mind now, it's almost like he has to destroy all the protomolecule so that action remains justified. And if you think about the mindset you get in when you're trying to juggle all those things, the sort of cognitive dissonance that would give a person, you can really see why he's struggling to keep his shit together.
And you can kind of see why Naomi maybe doesn't want to talk at great length about why she thinks he's wrong.
Yeah. It's just interesting how every single episode, your perception, at least for me personally, my perception of where that character is, it just changes. You know, and it's not like I'm ever like pro one person or anti another. It's just because they're all very, very very, very layered and very, very complicated. So, but it's just interesting how, you know, one week you'll be like, oh, wow, like I can't really believe, you know, like I had a problem with Naomi not being honest and getting mad at Holden for not being honest with her when she's not being honest with him. But then now this week it's like, yeah, but like now I'm kind of seeing a little bit more of like hesitation, but it's like she's dealing with somebody that's just not the person he was,
right?
You know, a few weeks back. And there's right there, it kind of becomes a trust issue too, because it's like, how can you trust somebody when like they're changing so much and not in a great way, you know? So like, could she even be honest with him right now? And like the way he is with what she's been holding back?
I would say no.
I know.
I mean, that's when you don't know where he's coming from and what he would do with that information. Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. This is the kind of stuff that I think about when I'm watching the show. So, I don't know.
I just have this meow, 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 meow. That's what's going on in my head as I watch the show.
Okay.
No. But, and we did, and we did talk a bit about, you know, the Vassarala, I want to say Sean thing. I have a real problem separating reality from fiction, but no, with the Vassarala and Aaron Wright and that whole scene, can you guys talk a bit about, you know, writing that and the idea of Aaron Wright just basically coming clean rather than trying to cover his butt or execute some clever ploy to, you know, not take responsibility for what he did?
The thing that I wanted to kind of say about Aaron Wright is he's a guy who's looking down the road of history and seeing his empire fading. He's right that this is kind of the last chance to get into a war with Mars and win. Mm. If they don't do it now, then they'll just lose. That's the future he's looking at. And he's been given this chance at a magic technology that will make that not be true. And it has blown up in his face. And I think what Sean was saying about, Aaron Wright is working from a place of altruism and is working from a place where he's genuinely trying to do the right thing. And I think that's all true. And I think that seeing him completely out of his depth and seeing him realizing that, you know, because what has, what's triggered him coming to to Abba Sarala is realizing that Mars is getting the magic thing. Yeah. Mars is getting the magic tech, and now they're boned. And if they don't do something to get it back, to somehow find a way to snatch a victory from the jaws of defeat, Mars will just be able to call the shots from now on.
And so does that, I mean, and we talk about these subtle evolutions of the characters over time. I feel like it's interesting that Ehrenreich, you know, he calls Abba Sarala out for the Earth First thing. He's like, that's always been my philosophy. Are we seeing Abba Sarala, I mean, obviously she's worried about Mars having the protomolecule, but are we seeing her move away from pure Earth First ideology towards more of like the Holden team, let's kind of try to be nice or do the right thing for each other type of thing at this point?
I think so.
Actually, well, I mean, I think the other thing that's happening with Ehrenreich, at least when we're sort of crafting the arc in the writer's room, is that at this point, Ehrenreich is playing for time. He knows that he doesn't see a solution to the problem. He doesn't see a solution yet to the problem with Mao and the protomolecule and Mars suddenly getting access to it and all of those things. He doesn't see a solution, and he knows if he goes down over the Eros thing, he'll never get a chance to find that solution. So he just needs to buy himself some time and hope that he can find that solution. And part of, I mean, yes, I think Sean is absolutely right. When he goes to Abba Sarala and unburdens himself to her, there is a part of him that is absolutely being truthful, that really hopes she will understand what he was doing and be sympathetic to what his goals were. You know, I mean, he even says, you were the one who taught me Earth First. Yeah, I was doing what you taught me to do. He's pleading with her to understand what he was doing, but he's also pleading for her to give him some time. And that's what she winds up doing. She winds up giving him some time, and the rest of its arc is because he had time to figure some things out. And over the next several episodes, you get to see what the solution he winds up coming up with. And I wasn't just, you know, blowing sunshine at Sean there. I really think Ehrenreich's arc over this second season is one of the most interesting things happening in the second season of the show.
Interesting. We'll have to see how that develops.
I think the last three episodes of this season really are, there's some brilliant Ehrenreich stuff in there. Some, especially in the last episode, there's some just amazing character work.
Really quick. I mean, and I know we have like one more thing before we get to shout outs, but even before we get to that thing, I kind of want to talk about, or at least give a nod to Alex's whole little moment that he had to himself.
Yeah, that was a wonderful little vignette.
Drunk,
yeah.
And listening to awful country music. And
that's Hank Williams. What are you talking about? Awful country music.
I don't like country music, so all of it's awful.
That's like a Stone country classic right there.
Finally, Cher has an opinion that I can agree with.
Thank you.
Finally,
I don't like country music at all.
No, country music is for entertaining mutants and farm animals.
Yeah, it's awful. It's awful.
Okay. So I'm the guy who's gonna be saying, no, country music is fine. Country music is good stuff.
No, it's not.
Hank Williams is the classic music of my nation and my generation.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm just saying, you don't have to like it, but you gotta respect it.
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, so the awful country music. But I did think the whole floating through the ship and catching the beer.
The FWI, floating while intoxicated.
My only regret about that scene is we didn't have him in his underwear. I mean, this is the pants always off at home scene.
He needed his hand on his pants at least. He needed like the zipper unzipped at least. That was a Homer Simpson in space moment. I mean, that's 100%. If Homer Simpson was by himself in space, that's what he would be doing, not eating donuts.
Yeah.
You should have had a space donut flying by and having him try to catch it with his mouth. But yeah, I felt like it was important to give a shout out because I'm sure Cass enjoyed. He looked like he was enjoying himself doing that. So shout out to Alex Kamal's space drunkenness.
Alex Kamal's one man house party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just got to get him better music.
But and as we wrap up, we mentioned it at the top of the episode, but I wanted to get your guys' take on the renewal and you know, what that experience has been like and all that kind of stuff. The renewal for season three. Yes.
Crickets.
Yep. I mean, I'm assuming you're...
I mean, what do you say? Yeah. I mean, I'm delighted. I'm grateful. I know kind of the shape that we're talking about doing for season three, and I think it's going to be awesome. It's, you know, it's a treat to be allowed to come back and do another round playing with these people and this team and telling more of the story. It's great.
Yes. And getting to spend another, production season in Toronto, watching Wes make fun of people is absolutely going to be the high point of my year.
I want to witness that.
There is nobody funnier on set than Wes.
We need like, video proof of that.
Yeah, some behind the scenes
as you guys shoot. Yeah, footage. So something on the special edition Blu-ray or something like that.
I like
that.
I don't know. You got to be careful with that because the funniest things Wes does is imitate somebody else talking. And I don't know. There might be hurt feelings.
Plus, you know, that means another season of The Churn. So I'm sure you guys are looking forward to that next year.
Wait, we didn't sign up for another year.
That's we'll
was that in the contract?
Yeah,
it was in the contract.
I don't remember that being in my contract.
No, we'll have our people call your people.
You agreed to that when we were getting drinks after Comic-Con. Yes. You agreed to it.
I don't remember any of this.
And on that note.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. I love you too. So let's go to shout outs.
Dun, dun, dun. We need the shout-out like out theme. Music. Yeah.
So what are you guys into this week? Who wants to start?
I will start. I finally got to at George's Theater, they just had the second season premiere of Happen Leonard. Finally got to catch up and watch all of the first season of Happen Leonard and love it. I love Joe Lansdale. I love his sort of dark, humorous, noir mystery kind of writing that he does, and I think Happen Leonard is kind of a fantastic show, and I'm really excited to see the second season coming out.
I've never even heard of this. What is it?
Oh, you're one of today's lucky 10,000.
There you go.
Happen Leonard is our series characters that Joe Lansdale uses in just a wide variety of his books, and that are now being adapted in television.
Okay.
And if you do, you know Joe Lansdale?
No.
Okay, so go get a book called The Bottoms.
Okay.
It's by Joe Lansdale. He's also the guy who wrote Bubba Hotep.
Oh.
He does a bunch of crime and horror novels with this kind of Texan voice that is brilliant. And he's a...
And the stars are Mark Antony from Rome and Omar from The Wire. So,
wow.
I mean, the two leads are fantastic. It's Michael K. Williams. And yeah. This is really going to piss me off because now I can't remember the name of the actor who played Mark Antony.
And he was also in Game of Thrones. He was Edmund Tully, wasn't he? Or Edmure, which one of the younger ones?
No.
I've okay. never seen The but Wire. I don't know.
He was not. No. Huh. But anyway, so the two leads are fantastic. The writing is great. They really captured Joe Lansdale's weird humor, darkly humorous noir kind of feel that he does so well. They've captured it in the show. I loved the first season. I'm really excited about the second season. So, yeah.
Okay, cool. What about, Danielle, what's your shout out?
I was recommended a book by a friend of mine, who was an editor when I was writing columns for Clark's World and is a music critic and, journalist. It's called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. And I got this because I trust this guy because the cover of the book looked just about as cheesy as I could imagine. And I was expecting it to be kind of this, you know, the dark gods and the Illuminati. But it winds up being this amazing examination of the way that rock music is associated with this kind of outsider vibe and how it was informed all the way back to the stories around the blues being informed by West African religions that were then cast as being satanic, and the thread of taking the other and demonizing them, and then accepting a kind of freedom by identifying with that against the larger culture, that it winds up being this sociology text that is beautifully written and really interesting and really rich. And I'm delighted to I got to pick this one up. So Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll by Peter Bebergall. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's worth looking at. It's an excellent book.
That sounds really cool, actually. I would totally read that.
Yeah.
Do you want to say your shout
out? I don't know if I really have a shout. I watched Frailty this weekend. That was a really good movie. With the Bill Paxton direct, I think it was a directorial debut, about a guy who is killing people in Texas and his two sons, and he believes that he is doing it because God told him to, and
then yeah. There's that thing at the end, yeah,
and no, then there's that thing at the end,
yeah,
yeah, and no, it's a really creepy, very 70s influenced movie, and you know, Bill Paxton having recently died, it was a nice little. Memory lane trip for that. So there you go.
I have a shout out, but now I have a question about Season of the Witch. Do they talk about how Led Zeppelin was like, they stayed in that house because Jimmy Page was very into the occult?
They are absolutely there. There's a bunch of stuff about Led Zeppelin in there. I'm still early enough in it that I'm mostly looking at the relationship between the myths of meeting the devil at the crossroads, mm-hmm. and how that fed back into voodoo and how that fed back into West African culture. But yeah, all of that, the Led Zeppelin's in there, Bowie's in there.
What about Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks?
I haven't seen anything about Fleetwood Mac in there yet. That may be coming later on.
Hmm. Okay, cool. All right, I just had to ask that. So my shout out, I mean, I told you guys before we started recording, but my shout out is for Into the Badlands, which is back for season two. And I am obsessed with the show. I'm so disappointed in myself that I wasn't watching it season one, but I binged watched it on Netflix. And it's fantastic. The fight choreography alone in the show is worth watching. Apparently, they treat the fight scenes like they would in a movie. So the actors actually go away to fight camp for weeks at a time. I think the guy that did the choreography for the fight scenes got like props from Jackie Chan, because that's how fantastic the fight scenes are. And it has a lot of, it's very multi-ethnic, the cast. It's very, I don't want to be like female empowering, but it is. It has a lot of badass chicks beating people up. It's just, I'm so obsessed with this show. So that's my shout out is Into the Badlands, which we're recapping on Fangirls. So definitely if you watch it, check out Fangirls every Sunday night for the recap. And that's it.
All right.
On that note, thanks to Sean Doyle for joining us. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks for Ty and Danielle for always doing this with us. And, you know, as always, you can find us on iTunes, on Google Play, Stitcher, a whole bunch of other places. Give us some love. And if you have any questions or comments or whatnot, you can always tweet us at Sci-Fi Wire. Until then, we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks.